Welcome to this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum. This series, we're asking our guests to address some big questions. And today's question asks what it means to be human in the 21st century. Our two guests are particularly well placed to help us think through this question. In the order you will meet them, they are Dr. Kiralee Thompson, Senior Research Fellow in Cultural Anthropology at Central Queensland University. Kiralee is a cultural anthropologist with varied research experience and interests. As well as working in ethnography and applied psychology, she has a considerable experience in human-animal interaction and human factors. Kiralee was the Radio National Uni NSW Top 5 Under 50 Science Communication Award winner in 2015. Her award-winning work investigated how people and animals, specifically horses, react to bushfires, and how non-verbal communication between them can act as therapy for disaster trauma such as post-traumatic stress disorder. Kiralee will be followed by Dr. Martin Lewison, who is Chief Technology Officer at Clevatar Proprietary Limited, an organisation which began as part of Flinders University, where Martin received his PhD. His research forte is the field of nature-inspired computing, specifically the application of biological principles to machine learning. He is a key participant of the Thinking Head Project, an ARC, NH and MRC special research initiative that targets the development of intelligent embodied conversational agents. So, Kiralee is going to talk about what it means to be human from a perspective of non-human intelligence, and Martin's going to add to that human-created intelligence, which I think is going to be fascinating. But Kiralee, will you lead us off?
Sure. Thank you, Charles. Thanks very much for inviting me to be here and to be a part of the Futures Foundation. It's a real privilege. So I'm going to talk about what makes us human. I don't know if I've ever been asked to present on a more complex topic. So really, I'm just going to give you a few thoughts to help you think through this question of what makes us human, but there's so much to be said on the topic. And I don't know any creature more basic and more complex than the human. So really, where do you start? All right, my background, I'm a cultural anthropologist. So I specialise in looking at humans and the differences between human groups at a cultural level. And the methods that have been developed in cultural anthropology are designed to help anthropologists get around what we call being ethnocentric. So if my aim is to go and understand how a culture views the world and what it's like to be someone from a different culture, for example, in my PhD research, I lived in Spain and looked at bullfighting. And I wanted to know, what do Spanish people think about bullfighting? In particular, how is the bullfight meaningful for a bullfighter? And if I was to be ethnocentric, as it's very easy for humans to be, if I was to be ethnocentric, I would have just interpreted the bullfight from my own Australian perception, which on the whole is that, well, the bullfight must be about animal cruelty. It must be about distancing the human and animal realm. It probably means people don't have much respect for the bull. But actually, when you go and hang out with bullfighters in Spain, you realise that the belief system and the meanings that they've made for the bullfight are such that it's a way of honouring and respecting the bull. It's not the way we see it. So from an ethnocentric perspective, I would be wrong in that I wouldn't be agreeing with what people do, what the insider's point of view is. And we often distinguish that as the emic versus the etic point of view. So as a cultural anthropologist, my job is to understand the world through other people's eyes without being ethnocentric. However, we might say, you know, a counter-argument to that philosophy might be, how could you ever understand the world from someone else's point of view? How could I know what it's like to be German or a Spanish bullfighter, when I don't even know that, as an Australian, I can see the world through your point of view either? So my experience of this event right now might be different to Charles's, because I have an egocentric bias, in a way. I only know the world through my own body and my own mind. But we can take that one step further And in the last few years, anthropology has really started thinking about, can we use all of these tools and methods and methodologies that we've developed to avoid ethnocentrism, could we use those to understand an animal's point of view and know what it's like to be an animal? And biologists have discussed this as well. It's not just a question for anthropologists. So from that perspective, we're also trying to avoid anthropocentrism. So how can I shed my cultural identity, my personal identity, and my human identity to actually understand another being's point of view? And these are really big questions, of course. But at the end of the day, we'll agree that we are all animals. So from that perspective, if I wanted to avoid anthropocentrism, there is something I have in common with animals, especially with mammals. And we know that we share a lot of DNA. We share more DNA with other creatures than we don't. So today I'm going to talk about humans as animals, but also what makes humans special. And I'm going to quote George Orwell here from his text, Animal Farm. Thank you. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. So what are the kinds of things that people have said distinguish the human animal from non-human animals? And non-human animals is a very political term that's been used a lot in the last few decades, just to emphasise the fact that humans are animals too. So I'll very quickly run through a list of the things people have said over the last 100 years or so that makes humans the ultimate animal or something above and beyond the average animal. One is language, but we've got enough research from biology to know that animals have their own language, of course, and that applies to a lot of the things in this list. Some people have said that culture is what distinguishes humans, but there's a lot of work on orca whales, for example, that says they have their own cultures. And if you were to take an orca from one region and put it in an aquarium with another, they might not get along because they've developed in different orca cultures. So we don't have dominion over culture either. Humans are bipedal. We have free hands. This has helped us, from an evolutionary perspective, develop into the kinds of animals that we are. And mostly that's the fact that we can use... we've developed the use of tools to much higher extent than other animals. But that's not to say other animals don't use tools. Humans might be the only animals to be able to create and handle fire. We have a very highly developed brain, but we'll get to that in a minute. We have a special ability to record detailed histories and pass them on from generation to generation. And that's probably something that we can do to a much better extent than animals. We're supposed to be the creatures that can make new and complex ideas and transfer them to others. When I've gone through the internet this last couple of days to think, okay, what are people saying humans are special for? I came up with this one. We're one of the few species to clothe ourselves. But a counter-argument might be that, you know, some animals will roll in mud to cover themselves for different reasons. Perhaps modesty here is actually the thing that distinguishes us. We are meaning makers, and towards the end of my talk, I'm going to talk about anthropomorphism, and I think that's a really, really important part of being human, that we actually seek to make meaning of what's going on around us. That's not to say that animals don't find the world meaningful, but perhaps they don't go to the same lengths that we go to create narratives and stories and reason behind the things that we see. The fact that humans are we're self-aware. I know that I am me and I am not you, and I am very different to my dog. I've got this awareness that I am a human. And so some people would say humans are the only creatures to have a mind, a sense of self, and consciousness about what's going on. Although more and more, as we advance in science, we're able to develop technologies that can read what's going on in animal brains. And every year we're closing the gap on what we think animals can't do that humans can. And we're seeing that there are regions of animals' brains that activate in the same way that human brains activate. Although we don't want to place too much emphasis on brain activity because we don't know what kind of meaning making and interpretation is happening to those biological signals. Religion, one might say that humans are the only creatures who have a religious system for explaining what goes on in the world. It's often religion also that says that animals don't have souls and so are lesser creatures. We cook food, That's not to say that other animals don't prepare food. There are birds that drop eggs from a height to crack them. There are certainly animals that take advantage of hot springs and sit in them and things like that. But we've gone through this whole list. And if we want to start talking about intelligence, I didn't specifically have on that list. Humans are the most intelligent animal. Intelligence is relative to what you need to do. And this is a great, great quote you've probably heard before from, it's attributed to Albert Einstein, although apparently no one can actually find where he said this. It's still a good quote nonetheless. Everyone is a genius, but if you judge a fish on its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid. So all of those things I've just listed, they're really useful if you're a human. They're not perhaps useful if you're a dog or a fish. And to continue talking about the way we privilege thought, this does seem to be the particular kinds of thoughts that humans are capable of having, and that we know that humans have them, we just don't know for sure if animals don't. But we have a lot of higher order thinking and reasoning. And René Descartes is famous for cogito ergo sum, which is I think, therefore I am. And this is tied to that whole sense of self. If I can think and be aware that I am a self, distinct from the world, that's what makes me fully human. And fully, note that I've said fully human. So we know that we know when we talk about other animals, something is, it's a dog or it's not a dog. We don't talk about being fully canine, but we do talk about being human, humane, having humanity. And we do scale other members of our species as being more or less human. That's probably something specific to us too. You won't catch dogs being suspicious that another dog is not fully dog. So what kinds of things are we busy thinking about? Well, we seem to, as busy as we are, we seem to have a lot of time on our hands, and we spend a lot of time thinking, well, what does it actually mean to be human? Which is the whole point why we're here today. What does it mean to be humane? What does it mean to be inhumane? Do we actually choose to be fully human? Just because I'm born a human, doesn't mean I am fully human, because of all of those cultural social values about what it means to be human or not. As a human, I can have thoughts about, well, I'm not a dog, what is it like to be a dog? What does that dog think about me? Does that dog have a category of human? Do dogs recognise that I'm human and so is my mother? Does my dog actually have a concept, a category that myself, my mother, my brother might fall into? Does the dog think about what it's like to be a dog? Does the dog think it's making choices to be a dog? So all of this actually just tells us what kinds of minds humans have. We're very questioning. We have questions about questions, and then we have more questions. So what we like to think about is, what kind of a world does a dog have? What kind of world does a horse have? What kind of world might a bull have? What kind of meaning does the bullfight have to a bull? And a term that we often use to talk about the life world or the life view of different creatures is this idea of umwelt. And a dog's umwelt is very different to a horse's umwelt or a human's umwelt. So dogs have a very sensory engagement with the world. Humans were much more visual and perhaps auditory. Something I want to, the concept that I really want to bring up, that I'm quite critical of in the way that scientists, I'm critical of the way scientists are critical of the term anthropomorphism. So we know that dogs have a different umwelt, but we know much less about what their umwelt has in common with our umwelt. And humans and dogs, we co-create worlds all the time. We generate experiences. I have a kind of language that I've generated with my dog. So this is not to say that these things are static either. We're actually always engaging, and animals are social actors, and they engage with us to generate and to produce shared meanings. So you might be familiar with the term anthropomorphism. It's quite strictly, if to anthropomorphise something, to anthropomorphise a dog, there's been a lot of debates recently about whether dogs know they're guilty or not, whether people can read a dog's face and they say, my dog knows it's done something and I can tell from its face. A strict, traditional, fundamental scientific view would be you shouldn't anthropomorphise that dog. Dog has its own world, and you're projecting human characteristics, human attributes onto the dog. And for scientists studying animals, in the same way that anthropologists want to avoid being ethnocentric, scientists have for very good reason avoided being anthropomorphic in attributing things to animals because it could be a barrier to actually understanding the animal's world. But I'm critical of the use of this term as something to be avoided at all costs. So you'll see from the definition I've got on the screen at the moment, anthropomorphism is the attribution of human characteristics to a non-human. But this term has kind of morphed or evolved lately to be taken as the erroneous attribution of human characteristics. And that's what I'm particularly critical of. So, anthropomorphism, I think, should be used more often to reflect doubt rather than an error. So horses or dogs may not experience happiness the way we do. Dogs may not experience guilt the way we do. They may not know that they've done something wrong the way we do. But neither do we know enough to say that they do not. So I think we need to start talking about this doubt. So, and this is all about the human-animal boundary. Yes, humans are special amongst the animal kingdom, but we also have a lot in common. We have more in common than we don't. And that's something that I think we've tended to forget as we like to think of ourselves as the most evolved species. And Charles Darwin says this very nicely. There is no fundamental difference between man and the higher mammals in their mental faculties. The difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is one of degree and not kind. So we're different from other animals by degree and not kind. It's a really important point. And actually, when it comes to some of the research that I've been doing in the last few years about animal welfare, a lot of the scientists in animal welfare have noticed that when people anthropomorphise animals, they can have really negative impacts for animals. With horse riders or horse owners, it might be the overrugging of animals, because it's easy for a horse owner to think, it's really cold outside, my horse must be cold, then to overrug the horse, then impede its thermoregulatory system. But at the same time, we need to work out, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. And a quote here from Endenberg about the potential benefits of anthropomorphism for animal welfare. So anthropomorphism may play an important role in the formation of the human-animal bond. And if this is true, the questions about preventing, denying the needs of companion animals whilst we're anthropomorphising them. So it's important that we also recognise that, like us, animals don't like to feel pain. Like us, racehorses probably don't like to be whipped. And some of the greatest atrocities against humans and animals that we've seen over history have been when humans have seen others as too different from themselves. So we need to tread this boundary between human and animal very carefully, and we need to accept a lot of responsibility. Which leads me to a quote from Dr. Paul Farmer, the idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that is wrong with the world, which is what I've just spoken about. And just to wrap up my talk, it wasn't long ago, in 1906, at the Bronx Zoo, there was an exhibit. It was in the primate enclosure. A pygmy, a human being, was exhibited alongside monkeys. And this was part of the early colonialist agenda of anthropology in particular, was to look at different human beings from an evolutionary perspective and place other human beings as being more or less civilized than us. So this is in the last 100 years that there were cases of human exhibits, as if we could look at other human beings as a device of saying how much better we are, how much more civilized we are. And this is an extreme case, but we do it all the time. You know, if we're honest with ourselves, we judge other human beings all the time, and we judge other animals, and that actually rationalizes the way we treat other beings. So to end on a happy note, I would like to use this talk to remind everyone to just be compassionate, even if science proves that we are the only creatures that can engage in higher functioning. We might be the only creatures that can actually engage in compassion. That could be the thing that sets us apart. But we need to be compassionate towards each other and towards animals nonetheless. And I'm interested to hear what Martin has to say about compassion, artificial intelligence. Could we create an artificially intelligent being with compassion? Very interesting question, which I'll throw out to you because you probably didn't even want to answer that with your talk.
Maybe I do.
Okay, all right.
Perfect.
Give you that challenge.
Perfect segue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, if you just click that off, and then we can...
I'll let you drive.
Light up lights here.
Hey, look, that's... I don't know how you tilted that screen, but it looks good.
Oops. I should put my glasses on, shouldn't I?
Do you want to swap seats?
No, I just need to see the screen, so actually your way out. All right, hello everyone. So we're dealing with a very big question tonight. What does it mean to be human? We probably wouldn't ask ourselves this question if we weren't a little bit uncertain about the answer, and particularly with the onslaught of technology these days and the prospect, certainly a prospect that has been debated a lot in fiction and depicted in movies, is that we might be replaced by machines one day. Is any of our humanity going to survive that? Now, I'm interested in the answer, not just because I'm a curious person, but also because it's a bit of a necessity. I'm in the business of making humans, actually. And it kind of helps knowing what humans are, if you're in that business. So I'm in good company, well, at least fictional company, because if you go back, you know, the early days of mankind, we have Prometheus creating man from clay. It's a very popular method to create man. And later on, a modern Prometheus, Dr. Frankenstein, using electricity, and even more modern interpretations such as the movie Ex Machina. In all of those cases, the creator of man has an unfortunate end. I'm hoping to avoid that fate by being somewhat less ambitious. Well, what's my background? I have a background in cognitive science, in artificial intelligence, specifically evolutionary computation, application of principles of biological evolution to solving problems on a computer. And I was brought on board a project, a very long-term project that is over now, that involved the creation of virtual humans that you would have a conversation with. And I continued that work with a startup that I've co-founded with some colleagues of mine a few years ago. That's Clavata. And at Clavata, we make virtual coaches that help people, mostly in the healthcare space. The logo has our first character, which is Anna. She was originally intended for an aged care application, but ended up being used to help people with their diabetes. And since then, we've created more different characters. It's a mobile app that runs on your phone or your tablet, and it gives you an interaction over time with a virtual human being that is trying to improve your life in various ways. So I'm firmly in the domain of creating humans in the virtual space, not robots or biotechnology or biology itself, but still creating humans as machines. And of course the term that everybody thinks of in that context is artificial intelligence. It's been a term that was coined in the mid-50s and that means a lot of different things. I'm not entirely sure what they all are. That being said, it's all about the idea of creating man from a machine. That idea has been around since the machine has been around. 200 years ago we had the Mechanical Turk, a chess-playing machine that could beat humans. Of course, there was a tiny human hidden inside that machine, so it wasn't actually real, but it fascinated people, the idea of having a machine that could beat them at something that only humans can do, play chess. But the idea of having a machine be human, well, that has motivated the earliest scientists in the field of computing, such as Alan Turing, very much. And of course, what they were thinking about human nature at that stage, and that certainly reflects also in this chess-playing machine, is that, you know, what differentiates us from animals is our logic, our reason. And if you can create a machine that is logical and reasonable, then surely we could replicate the abilities of the human being and maybe even outperform it. So we did. We created machines that filled into our rooms and are now just a fraction as fast as your mobile phone in your pocket. But these machines were better at maths and logic than humans were. So people got very excited in the 1950s and thought it would not take very long at all to create machines that would outsmart human beings eventually. And of course, as we know, that didn't really happen so far, and certainly not nearly as quickly as people were predicting. They were thinking 10 or 20 years from now, which was the mid-50s. What we did end up with were very shaky robots. This robot was actually called Shaky, and they could only operate in a completely artificial environment. And if anything real was encountered by this robot, it would completely and utterly fail. And the paradox here was that what people thought was hard, maths and logic, that was actually quite easy. Whereas the easy things, they were actually quite difficult. So even nowadays, if we think of a mathematician, we think of them as being very smart, and a bricklayer, not so much, right? That kind of underlying assumption turned out not to be actually true, though. You know, the things that are hard for humans are not necessarily hard for other beings, particularly machines. So this wasn't going to go anywhere, eventually. If you tried to solve everything with logic and reason, it turned out that the world is full of incomplete and uncertain information, and logic doesn't help you that much. Unfortunately, some other researchers, at around the same time that the original computer was invented, decided to look at how nature solves problems. And this is often categorized as computational intelligence, as a subfield of artificial intelligence. There are different things that happen in nature, from evolution to human brains, and that can be used as inspiration. Even immune systems have been used as inspiration for problem solving. And one of the most obvious ones, of course, is the human brain, which is made up of a very, very large number of several hundred billion neurons and trillions of connections between them. And these neurons, well, people don't really understand them that well. They are incredibly complex, and there are a lot of them, and they interact in mysterious ways, and we have lots of researchers trying to untangle what's going on there. It may take a bit longer. And that didn't stop anyone, even in the 1940s, from trying to abstract them, to find out what is the essential nature of these, and try to come up with a mathematical equation, basically, that represents them. Now, that may have very little to do with how neurons really operate, but it can be a useful exercise. So the artificial neuron is greatly simplified. It takes some numbers and processes them and produces some output. And you can create networks of these that then take a bunch of numbers and transform them into some output. The idea is here that the bunch of numbers that I'm talking about, they might be a picture, there might be a sound, there might be a sentence represented as numbers. And the output might be then the identity of the person in that picture. So the question is, how do we find that transformation to transform the picture into the person? And all problem-solving tasks really are tasks of searching. You can solve them by randomly trying stuff. Okay, that will always work. You will always find a solution eventually. It might take the age of the universe to do that, but you will find a solution. With these artificial neural networks, it turns out that they have useful mathematical properties that make it a bit easier than that to find this kind of transformation, to find the solution. Okay, if we use examples of what we want, faces of people and their identities, then we can actually search effectively, fairly effectively, for that transformation. All right. It's still computationally very intensive. So until about 10 years ago, these kind of techniques were regarded as, interesting, but not necessarily something that every researcher would pursue. I was involved with them, with these kind of technologies, because they were nature-inspired, and that was my domain. But a lot of people would say, oh no, we're using something else like these and statistics and things like that. But 10 years ago, what we ended up with were computer gamers. Basically, lots of computer gamers out there, they love their computer games, and it turns out that 3D mathematics is hard, and in order to play very beautiful computer games, you had to have very fast computers with hardware specialized to do a certain kind of maths that was actually very similar to the maths that you needed to do neural network solution finding training. All right, and that resulted in a bit of a revolution. Okay, now you could create very large networks that outperformed other techniques out there, and we could achieve things that we didn't think possible previously. We managed to beat the best player in Go. Okay, Go was considered to be the hardest game for a computer to play. But nowadays, a computer can easily beat the best player out there. All right, that was considered impossible with good old-fashioned AI, with logic and reason. All right, not a challenge. More closely related to the nature of neural networks I explained a moment ago is facial recognition, scene recognition. We can now take a picture and have a computer explain to us what is on that picture, describe the scene, who's on that picture, how old are they, what's their gender, what's their identities. We can do that. Okay, we 10 years ago that was actually very hard, 20 years ago completely unimaginable. Now we have that in some of our phones these days actually. So some of the implications of these kind of technologies are still to unfold. Okay, we could imagine a future where we don't need any form of cash because computers will know where we are at all times. That we know whether we entered a shop and left a shop and what we picked up. Actually, that is reality. Amazon has already started a number of stores called Amazon Go where you don't actually have to pay when you leave. You can just leave because cameras and other sensors are watching you and know exactly what you're doing. And you can imagine governments would be very keen to follow you everywhere you go as well. And the implications for democracy, I think, are quite profound there. Does that mean that we have machines that are human intelligence? No, not really. The thing is that these technologies are very specific. They can solve one particular problem extremely well, better than humans can. But you can't really make these algorithms learn multiple things at the same time easily. And quite importantly also, you can't easily train them. They need a lot of examples. So AlphaGo needs to play 5 million games. I think the head of Google Brain said, you know, everybody should be doing machine learning, you only need 100,000 samples. Okay? Now, I don't need to watch 100,000 videos of hammering a nail into the wall to know how to use a hammer. So humans are actually much better at learning things from very few examples and learning many different things. Machines are not good at that at all. So we now have artificial intelligence that's better at a lot of things than humans are. Whether that was originally logic or now it's pattern recognition, you know, recognizing things and the adverse conditions. So what's unique about humans now? Well, we call it general intelligence, and the holy grail now is to create artificial general intelligence, to create an intelligence that can easily learn things. Just you show them some examples and they know what to do like a human. Okay, so that's the last sort of remaining goal that's out there. And when are we going to solve this? Well, some people say it's very soon, but you have to consider that many of these algorithms that are creating groundbreaking outcomes right now, well, they're 20 or 30 years old. Okay, the only reason they're working quite well at the moment is because the computers got faster, and people were playing computer games, obviously. So, you know, maybe those algorithms that will solve all these problems, they are around already, maybe not. And it could take another few decades for us to be able to find out. There has been an argument, I went to an AI conference recently, that nobody will want to create artificial general intelligence anyway, because it's like a multi-tool, you know, it's no good at anything specifically. And plus, we have a lot of humans on the planet anyway, you know, we can just use them. But I think, generally speaking, you are better at one thing if you know a few other things as well. If you look at self-driving cars, if self-driving cars can understand humans very well and even interact with them, they're going to be better at being a self-driving car, and that will drive, I think, future work towards an artificial general intelligence. A second argument that's quite interesting is that is there only one kind of artificial general intelligence? And to go back to that example from search, where we're searching just randomly to find a solution. Well, there is a theorem in search called the no free lunch theorem. It basically states that if we look at problem solving, that if you're good at solving one kind of problem, it means that there is another kind of problem out there that you are actually particularly bad at. All right. So there's perhaps no single artificial general intelligence. What we can have is intelligence that are better at something than other things. So if we have an intelligence that is maybe quite human-like, it will probably lose all its money when it goes to the casino, right? Because it's terrible at stats. And that's quite possible. So what kind of artificial intelligence do we want to interact with? We'll probably want to interact with the ones that are more human-like. And that's where I'm going to leave for the rest of this lecture, that we are going to select the future of artificial intelligence. It is going to be human-like because that's what we like to interact with. So the idea that you want to interact with a human is something that arose very early on, of course, the Turing test. and Turing came up with a way of working out whether, you know, a computer was human, as intelligent as a human. Well, you chat to something, someone, and you try to work out whether they're a human or a computer, all right? If you can't distinguish the computer from the human, then that must mean the computer is as intelligent as a human being. And there have been some theoretical arguments against this, you know, basically claiming that you know, the computer could fake it, they could just come up with all the right answers and not understand anything, right? But then again, you know, that could be true for everyone in this room, and I'm the only intelligent person, and you guys are just making it up. It's just not a fair assumption, not a particularly useful assumption either, right? So, we had Turing tests run every year for many, many years, even in Adelaide. It's a Loebner Prize that you can win a bit of money if you actually manage to pass the test for a reasonable time period. Now, it's very easy to work out whether you're talking to a computer, because most of these computers, computer programs and computers themselves, they're created by single individuals who don't have unlimited amounts of money. So these computers don't have a body, so they don't know a lot of things about the physical environment. They don't know what happens if you step on a banana peel or whatever. It's like, you know, if you have a congenitally nearly blind person, if you talk to them about the beauty of sunsets, eventually you'll find out that, you know, no, they have never seen one. Likewise with a computer program. Well, you know, these computer programs can manage to get some people to think that they're human. For a while, all right? And part of the reason is that humans are actually stupid, stubborn, obnoxious, and all sorts of other things that mean that they can actually sometimes get away with not having to be very human-like or having to be very intelligent in the first place. All right. So it's really about social manipulation. If you can have a computer program that can somehow dodge the difficult question in a convincing way, then we might attribute human intelligence to it. And in fact, look, we are talking to computer programs every day these days. Many of us already have these smart speakers at home. You can speak to them and they will give you answers to everything. And I think 25 million or so this year, about half a million have professed their love to them, a quarter million have want to marry them, and every day thousands get wished a good morning. So we have already started to have this kind of social relationship with these machines. And clearly we are going to pick the machine that is the most charming, probably. If it's not very nice to us, we might replace it with a different box that is better, right? And that will drive the evolution of these devices. Now, my background is in the space of conversational agents, that is, creating machines that you can talk to. And when we have a conversation, of course, if we talk on the phone, it's just a voice. If we chat, it's even only text. But naturally, we actually communicate with more than just words. We actually communicate with our antibodies. I'm waving my hands right now, I have a gestured gaze. And if you're very good at this, you'll make a good salesperson, good politician, I think. But we actually don't have a very good formal understanding of how this communication works. Some of us are good at it, maybe able to teach it, but our scientific understanding is quite poor. And one of the reasons is that it's actually difficult to reproduce. I mean, if you're good at it, you might not behave the same way the second time around. So doing experiments in that space is quite difficult. So this project that I was involved with at the university, it was a very large project when I was about 7 years with several universities, was to resolve this problem by creating a virtual human being that you could interact with. And then we could actually study what we understand to be the right kind of behavior that you should have during communication and see how people respond to it. Okay. You had to create a virtual person, of course, on a computer, and that was why I was brought on board, because I have an AI background, and you do need something that's reasonably responsive, of course. We started off with a head, that's what it was called, the Thinking Head project. And this project didn't just involve computer scientists, it involved a lot of psychologists, too many of those really, and an artist, Stelak, who lent us his head. And we created a model of his head and animated it and gave it life. And Stelak is a lovely guy, but people didn't really like his head that much. One of the early participants said it reminded him of her of an ex-murderer, and she would refuse to continue participating in this experiment. So we explored a lot of different appearances and the nature of appearance and behavior of a virtual human being and how people would respond to those. And people responded very strongly. My background is AI. I was trying to make things smart, but people would respond just strongly to just appearance itself. I mean, we, as humans, we look at people's faces and we immediately judge whether they're trustworthy or not, whether we are willing to converse with them without them ever actually saying a word. We could argue that we're very superficial. And also, another question that arose, of course, during the creation of this virtual person was, well, how realistic does this person have to be? Because it's actually quite difficult to create something that's perfect. We have some colleagues in New Zealand, a startup called Soul Machines. They specialize in creating human-like virtual characters that you can interact with. That's one end of the spectrum, essentially. Fairly good rendering animation, you would notice that it's not quite right, and behavior is another challenge altogether. You could go the other way, you can have an anthropomorphic paper clip. As you know, Clippy was not very popular, but that wasn't because it wasn't the right idea, it was just a terrible execution at the time. So what is good? You know, do we want to have realistic, not realistic? Well, there's an effect known as the uncanny valley. And the uncanny valley was devised in the 1970s by a Japanese researcher who explored some work in this space. The Japanese are pretty fond of androids over there, so it's quite relevant. And what was noticed was that, you know, people feel familiar and generally like something that is more human-like, but if it is too human-like, well, it better be perfect. If it's not perfect, but very human-like, it will respond very negatively to it. All right? And part of the reason for that is that we have expectations, of course, and these expectations go up as the humanness of that creation goes up as well. And we become disappointed. We look for cues that may not be there, or cues that may be there that indicate that the person is sick or untrustworthy or otherwise. So, as a result, you know, most movies these days that are animated actually back off from being human-like. They try to go back to that peak in that uncanny valley that is just before perfection, and try to stick around there. And the same is what we do the same at Clevata. We don't try to be human, completely human-like. Of course, we are all very sensitive to these sort of things because our brain is very social. We've spent the last 100,000 years around other people. People are dangerous. They are beneficial. There's nothing quite like other human beings. We have to get along with them really well. So the brain is hardwired to process other human beings really well. You know, we can recognize and analyze faces faster than any other pattern, for example, despite the complexity of the face itself. We respond very strongly to anything. If somebody smiles at you, you will respond to it. There's very little you can do about that because you've been trained and evolutionarily programmed to respond to these sort of things. So what that means is that we could have a computer program that tries to tap into that. A computer program that tries to deliberately tap into social cues and try to make you feel things and feel a relationship, a bond to the computer program because it knows the right things to say and show is called a relational agent. And the simplest relational agent, and very exploitative but successful, were the Tamagotchis of the 1990s. These were little computer programs that you had to look after them, otherwise they would die. And people would get very addicted to them because otherwise they would die, right? That's a bad thing. Socially, very unacceptable to have just somebody die in your presence. Not very nice at all. But we've had researchers try to do something nicer, like this MIT project. FitTrack was a virtual agent with a depiction of a woman who would try to encourage you to do more exercise, and she would smile at you when you did a good job, and she would be disappointed if you didn't. And it was very difficult for people to disappoint the computer program because it had a face, it had a name, it had a personality. It was just hard for people. Okay, it wasn't as hard as maybe a real person, but it was much more difficult than an ordinary computer program. And so we've seen other examples of that. The military in America did something in their PTSD space as well. And Clevata, of course, is basically pursuing that idea with our virtual health coaches, where we try to encourage people to manage their diabetes, their anxiety, their depression, their heart disease through a virtual character that you are meant to bond with, and that will look after you, and that will be very happy to see you succeed. And get people to actually change their behavior as a result. All right. So this was basically the research that we had at university, and now distilled into a more commercial kind of offering. That nevertheless, you know, it's mostly governments and healthcare organizations that are actually funding us and rolling this out. So where am I going to end up with this? Well, the future is human, all right? Despite the fact that we have machines that are becoming very good at manipulating us, machines that are good at becoming at solving problems that only humans used to be good at. Well, these machines don't exist in isolation. Sure, in movies they exist as products of some black side and mad scientists, but in reality, we will be living with these kind of intelligences for quite a while before they will really become super intelligent. And if you look at something like the Terminator, you know, you wouldn't want that to, you know, babysit your daughter or even mow your lawn, right? You're just not going to pick it. What you are going to pick is something that you love, that you enjoy, that you want to interact with because it's charming. And look, we don't even need intelligence to know what these sort of things are, you know. Billions of dollars get made with certain characters that, you know, we can't stand anymore, like the Frozen characters, because, you know, they're everywhere now, but that's because people love them. And people, they might not be real, but it doesn't really matter. Celebrities aren't actually real. They are real to an extent. It's really annoying to their PR people, of course, but you know, they're fictitious. And we actually have fictitious pop stars, like this Japanese pop star here, who people go to a concert to watch, you know. It's not a real person, but people are fans of. So if you give this intelligence, you can imagine people are just going to go wild about it. And we will see an evolution of some sort happening there, where people will select the intelligences that they like the most, and eventually that they love the most. And maybe what we love is a copy of ourselves, like this Japanese android is a copy of his creator. Maybe it's something more abstract, but what it will be is it will have distilled the essence of what is human, because that's what we want to be surrounded with, I think, in terms of certainly the positive side of humanity. And of course, what I do want with Cleverta, for example, is I want to create a bunch of characters that you love as well. Because ultimately, that's what's going to be what will make you adopt them, what will make you interact with them, what will make sure that they make a difference to your life. In our case, it's about making your health better, but you can imagine that they could just be companions in general and help you with all sorts of things. And so I think that's what the future is going to look like. Not cold machines, but entities that we will absolutely adore. That may be scary in some way as well, but it's quite different from what we see in movies, I think. And that's basically it. Thank you very much.
Wow. Yes. Yeah. Look. There's only.